Okay, everyone, so let us continue where we left off this morning. Yeah. We're just looking at the connection between craving and upadana, which is attachment or grasping or taking things up, taking hold of things. And this is one short little extract from a sutta, which I will read up, and then we can move on to the next link in the series between upadana and bhava coming up next. But let's just have a very quick look at this tiny little extract here. Basically, the main importance of this one here is this. The Buddha says the Arabic is these two views, the views of existence and the view of extermination. It's a bit hard to understand exactly why that is mentioned here. It is a bit part of the broader context, but let's just leave that aside because it's not so important for this. Therein, bhikkhus, the instructed noble disciple reflects thus, is there anything in the world that I could cling to without being blameworthy? He understands thus, there is nothing in the world that I could cling to without being blameworthy. For if I should cling, in other words, if I should attach, if I should take something up, if I should grasp something, it is only form that I would grasp, only feeling that I would grasp, only perception that I would grasp, only willed activities that I would grasp, only consciousness that I would grasp. With that grasping of mine as condition, there would be existence. With existence as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair would come to be. Such would be the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So what is happening here is just summarizing what we have seen before, because the bhikkhu understands that the view of existence and the view of extermination, they are obviously wrong. They are the views that require you to believe in some permanent entity behind it. So because he knows that, then he understands that there is nothing that he could cling to in the whole world and still not be blameworthy. In other words, blameworthy here is a very broad idea of blameworthy. Savajja, I think the Pali word is. In other words, blameworthy in the sense that I will suffer the consequences, right? So if I blameworthy here just means that you're doing something which leads to suffering here. And because he understands that whatever he clings to, everything really can be summarized in these five aggregates, these five factors, these five aspects of personality, which are, of course, form, feeling, perception, will formations, and consciousness. Everything can be summarized in that. All of those, of course, he understands are impermanent. And because all of those are impermanent, then there's nothing in the world that he can grasp onto, hold on to, that will not lead to suffering. All of this will lead to suffering here. So it's interesting. It means that, you know, I was talking just a little bit cheekily about clinging to, you know, buying a sports car, for example, earlier today. And the idea here, of course, is that the sports car really is a part of our perception. It's how we perceive that sports car that is important. And it kind of lives inside of us, in our mind, as a perception, as a feeling. That's really what it is. And for this reason, even that sports car can be summarized here as being part of one of those five khandhas. So this is how the whole world, our whole experience really is an aspect of these five khandhas, one way or another. So there's nothing you can grasp to, right? Because everything leads to problems eventually. That is what this is saying here. So I kind of summarize that quite nicely. Then we can move on to the next stage. What it says here is that clinging or grasping or taking up or attachment is the condition for existence. With the cessation of attachment, there is the cessation of existence. And what, bhikkhus, is existence? Pali, what is bhava? There are three kinds of existence: sense sphere existence, form sphere existence, formless sphere existence. This is called existence. So again, this explanation of existence here is a kind of all-inclusive explanation. All forms of existence are included within the form-sphere existence. sense sphere existence and a formless sphere existence. Nothing is outside of this. This is kind of takes into account every possible type of existence. The word bhava, existence, quite literally means just that. It means existence. So, you know, the existence right now, here we are, all of us, in the sense sphere existence, right? This is literally what it means. So it's there's nothing kind of really hidden behind that. And the idea here that clinging leads to existence, or attachment leads to existence, is quite easy to understand why that is the case, and how that is the case, once you understand what these things are referring to. So when you are attached to things, right, you have a house, you have all these things in your life that you own, you have your relationships, you have your ideas and all these kind of things, because you are attached to those things, because you grasp them, because you consider them yours, because you consider them under your control, you think about them, right? These are the things that are important to you in your life. Those things that you're attached to are the things your mind ruminates about. You ruminate about it, you always go back to that. You know, if you live as a husband or a wife or a family member, you often very often think about those family members. Your mind kind of lives in that sphere, so to speak. It lives in the sphere of your possessions. If you know how your mind works, you know what I'm talking about. It's very easy to see that. So once you have a number of attachments, a number of views, and all of these kind of things, your mind has a tendency to exist within that realm of those things. That is where the mind kind of hangs out, thinking about those things. And because of that, making karma also according to that. That is where we make karma. These are the things that are important to us. These are the things that matter to us. So we react to those things. When they change, we get upset. When they go our way, we are happy and we are pleased. And our desire and craving increases as a consequence. So we make karma. We kind of exist there in the mental way. And then we make karma in accordance with that. And this is the idea of bhava here, existence. Our whole mental world is created by what we cling to, what we hold on to, what we attach to, what we grasp onto in this world. And we live in accordance with that. And then the karma is created in a similar fashion. The suttas, or rather, as I said, the commentaries, they sometimes distinguish between two types of bhava, what is called the upapatti bhava and the upapatti bhava and the kamma bhava. The kamma bhava is what really is meant here in dependent origination, as I understand it. It is the creation of kamma in this life. And then the upapatti bhava is the re-arising bhava, the existence that happens when you get reborn. So that is very similar to the idea of jati, which is the next step on this path. So these things all kind of come together in this way here. So, and of course you can experience these things for yourself. Just look at your mind. Where does your mind hang out? What is your mind preoccupied with? What is important in your life? What is the thing that your mind goes back to again and again and again? And that is, in a sense, your bhava. That is where you exist in a very real sense, because that is where your mind hangs out and exists. So that is the link there. Now I'd like to have a look at there's a couple of suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya that are called the Bhava Suttas in the Anguttara 3, and they give a very nice exposition of how Bhava is explained. It's a little bit broader here than the way it is explained in dependent origination, but it's roughly the same idea. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Bhante, it is said, existence, existence. In what way, Bhante, is there existence? If, Ananda, there were no karma ripening in the sensory realm," this is the karma loka, right? "Karma vachara, would sense sphere existence be discerned? No, Bhante. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, karma is the field, consciousness is the seed, and craving the moisture for the consciousness to be established in an inferior realm. In this way, there is the production of renewed existence in the future." So here, the Buddha is saying, if there is no karma ripening in the sensory realm, you cannot have sense-sphere existence, right? Sense-sphere existence depends on that karma. So it depends on your consciousness right now being stuck, having created lots of karma in this life, which is pointing you towards a sense-sphere existence, your consciousness having the quality of a sensual desire, being kind of imbued with that, and pointing towards more sensual desire in the future. This is the karma right here and right now. And because of that, of course, sense-sphere existence then happens in the future. So very obvious in a sense, without one, you cannot have the other. The mind has to kind of hang out within these realms, so to speak. And then he has this nice way of phrasing it. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance, infected by craving. This is one of those statements that you see many places in the suttas, and it's very nice. Hindered by ignorance, right? Ignorance blinds you. Ignorance stops you from seeing reality as it actually is. Ignorance means that you're walking around in darkness, not seeing anything. This wonderful idea that ignorance just stops you from achieving anything. One of my favorite similes for ignorance is found in the with the Te Vidya, the three knowledges that happen at the very end of the gradual training. And you see there, the simile there is like the simile of the chick, you know, the little chick inside the egg, right? And the simile is like before you understand the three vidyas, of course. The first one is the recollection of past lives, right? So before you recall the past lives, you're like the chick inside the egg. You can't see anything, right? When you're inside an egg, you see the eggshell around you. Your world is incredibly limited. There's almost nothing there, nothing happening here. Tiny little world inside that you live. And then one day, the chick has grown big enough to be able to use its beak, to be able to use its claws, to hatch through the eggshell, to release itself from that eggshell. And then it sees the world. So imagine, right? You think the world is all there is inside this eggshell. And then one day, you hatch. Wow, what a difference. You know, the world is just so different from what you thought it was. The reality is just so enormous and so massive compared to this little world you saw inside the eggshell. And exactly the same way, the idea of rebirth, when you see it for the first time, it's like hatching from this eggshell. You thought life was this tiny little slither of time. You get born here, you die there, this tiny thing in between. And suddenly reality opens up and you see, whoa, it is something so enormous, with so much potential, with so many different realms that you can be reborn in. And with this enormous expanse of time, going back into the past, indefinitely, potentially going into the future indefinitely as well. So this is the idea of ignorance, right? It is very limiting. We are so limited, our understanding of the world. We are so trapped in this darkness. And this is the other thing, that the other simile also found in this Te Vidya, it's like you are in the darkness. You're fumbling around, don't know where you're going. You don't know up from down, down from up. You're trying to kind of feel your way around, but you can't see anything. And then one day the light gets turned on, and then you can see. Now I understand. Now I see what's going on. So this is the thing. And this is also why the Buddha is called the eye of the world, right? So he's the eye of the world, because he sees first. And because he sees first, he tells everybody else, listen, I've seen this. This is the reality. And you listen to him and you think, okay, let's check it out. And then he becomes the eye of the world. You follow after where he has gone first. This idea of blinded, or here it has hindered by ignorance, is very real, because you have no idea what is actually going on. And because of that, you make all kind of wrong decisions based on that. Right decisions can only be made when you see things in the correct way, right? If you don't see things in the correct way, how can you make right decisions? It's impossible. Ignorance just makes you make all kinds of stupid decisions. And that's why we pursue suffering when we think we are pursuing happiness. We pursue happiness when actually sometimes we think we're pursuing suffering. So it's weird. Everything is like upside down and inverted. The vipalasas are in charge. And fettered by craving, right? Fettered by craving. Craving is what chains us to existence. Craving ties us down. Craving points us to a new life. When you finally think you're going to die, you think, hooray, I'm out of here, finished with all this. And then craving says, no, you're going to move on into the next life as well. Craving ties you down to samsara. Craving craving projects you into a new existence, always thinking about the future, always projecting yourself into something else. So for these beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving in this way, kamma is the field, right? Kamma is like this playground, this enormous thing that you are creating. All the kamma together is the kamma bhava. The kamma bhava is this enormous play. So sorry, the kama bhava or the kama vachara, the realm of sensuality is this. Lots of potential places to be reborn. It's like this enormous field, and somewhere in this enormous field, your seed of consciousness will stick itself in there. And once it gets stuck in that field somewhere, then you start to grow in that field. So it's a kind of nice metaphor for kamma, right? You're creating this field whereby you will move in the future, and you get stuck in that field like a seed somewhere in that field. So consciousness is the seed. This is like we were talking, somebody asked the other day about the Patisandhi Vijnana. And this is a bit like that. The Patisandhi Vijnana is the rebirth link in consciousness. It's the one that leads to getting stuck in that field. And you can see here how that fits fairly well with how this sutta is talking about it. So this sort of consciousness gets stuck in that field. And then to be able to grow in that field, you need moisture. Right? And that is what craving supplies. Craving is the moisture. It supplies the nourishment, the moisture, the water that is required. And then the consciousness starts to grow, right? And the plant arises. A being arises from that soil in that field as a consequence. And you create more kamma, and then it continues on like this from life to life. So a very nice simile for understanding roughly what is going on here. And this is the way that consciousness then gets established in an inferior realm. The kama dhatu, the kama vachara, is here the inferior realm. In this way that there is production of renewed existence in the future. Right? And then of course we have the other realms as well. If, Ananda, there were no kama ripening in the form realm, would form sphere existence be discerned? No, Bhante. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, kama is the field, consciousness is the seed, and craving is the moisture for the consciousness to be established in the middling realm. In this way, there is the production of renewed existence in the future. Again, we can see here this, which I mentioned before, the idea that the rupa bhava, the rupa vachara, which is equivalent to the jhanas, is here called the middling realm, right? So once you get to the jhanas, you're kind of in the middling realm. So the, again, the Buddha has very high standards for what he calls the middle here. And if, Ananda, there were no kamma ripening in the formless realm, would formless sphere existence be discerned? No, Bhante. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, kamma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture for the consciousness to be established in the superior realm. In this way, there is a production of renewed existence in the future. It is in this way, Ananda, that there is existence. You can see here how existence here kind of goes across from one life to another one. There is the kamma you create in this life, which is the kamma bhava, and then there is the re-arising which results from that, the seed of consciousness being planted in the field of a future life. That is the upapatti bhava the commentaries talk about. But in terms of dependent origination, I would say it's only really the kamma bhava which is relevant, because jati itself, that is the upapatti which re-arises as a consequence of that kamma. Technical point, and anyway. So there you are. That is the sutta there on bhava, and this is one of the clearest explanation of bhava and how that bhava comes about according to the suttas. Okay, so let us maybe move on to the next sutta, and this sutta is called the Leash, and this is from the Khanda Samyutta. And this one here I like in particular because of the nice similes it has further down. But let's read the whole thing because it is still, there's a number of nice things in this one. because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So we have seen a number of these things already. The idea of things being without discoverable beginning, right? This important statement by the Buddha, that no matter how far back in time, you can never actually find a first point. This is one of those things that you cannot find the first point. So there's no discoverable beginning here. And as I mentioned before, there's a big difference between saying there is no discoverable beginning here and there is no beginning here. There's a big difference there in terms of, in terms of philosophy and outlook. And I think this is one of the things that makes the Buddhist religion, Buddhist teaching very special and very unique. The fact that we don't posit any kind of theories or any reality that we cannot know about. The Buddha talks about things that he has seen, and this is the difference. The vast majority of religions, in Christianity, in Islam, in Hinduism, or whatever, they talk about the theories of how the world started out, right? God created the world in 7 days, kind of the Christianity. In Hinduism, there is this idea of Brahma. How does it go again? First there was water, and then this kind of different types of mythologies, apparently, according to Brahmanism or Hinduism. And I'm not no expert on these things. But the main point is that there are all these ideas, these mythologies, these legends about how the world came about. And we know they're all just legends, right? They're just kind of ideas, they're stories kind of made up to explain how the world began. There's this craving in human beings to understand how everything began, right? I very often want to get asked as a monk, but what is the Buddhist idea of the origin of the universe, right? How do Buddhists think about this? There's this feeling we need to know about beginnings. We need to have some kind of narrative, some kind of overarching story that tells us about how the universe came about, how everything came into existence. It's one of the desires, it seems, deep in the human heart to have clarity about these things. But Buddhism is different. It's one of the only places where you find, actually, we can't know this. We have no idea. How can we possibly know these things? There is no inference that can tell us how that this has always been like this. Because it is infinity we're talking about here, we're talking about something that can never be known by a human mind, including the Buddha, so it seems here. So this is very interesting, and it's a bit unsettling perhaps, right? It feels a bit like you are left out. You are just in the middle of this ocean, the middle of nowhere. You have no idea of the boundaries. You're just in the middle of this somewhere, floating along. And when the next Buddha comes around, maybe he won't even be able to remember us. We may have disappeared into the mist of history here. There's no memory of us anymore. We are outside, perhaps even of those eons that can be remembered by a Buddha, perhaps, down the line somewhere, that will happen. And it's kind of unsettling here. But also, at the same time, it is probably very realistic. This is probably how the world kind of works. And this is nice, right? It's good to know that you're dealing with a realistic teaching and not with something that is just a legend and mythology here. And then it has this nice idea, a first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, right? I love this little point here. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on. If you look back in time, you look back, life before life, going back eon before eon, and all you see is yourself wandering around, roaming around aimlessly. The nice thing about this English word to roam, the idea of roam has this sense of aimlessness, right? Purposeless. You're kind of roaming around in the forest or roaming around in a shopping center somewhere, just kind of not really knowing where you're going, right? And this is actually what samsara is like. There is no aim to it. There is no purpose. You're not actually heading towards the exit. Just doing the same mistakes again and again, going here, going there. And after a while you think, why? What's the point of this? It is completely pointless. All I'm doing is just experiencing suffering, not actually having any goal, any purpose. And this is so different from how we experience life. right? When we experience life, we kind of grow up. I remember what it was like myself. You know, you grow up and you go to university and you have this idea in your head that life is so purposeful. You have this sense that I'm going towards a career. I'm going to make something out of my life. I'm going to get married. Perhaps I'm going to have a house, right? And all of these kind of things. And you have this, and it seems so purposeful. It seems like you're actually doing something. And then sometime as you're doing this, you kind of get to your midlife crisis. Many people have the midlife crisis, right? This was one of the questions I had to answer at the interview yesterday. Well, people get the midlife crisis and they buy a sports car. Well, is that the best way to have a midlife crisis? or the best way to use it, perhaps, rather? And of course, this is because you start to realize that dream you were having, that kind of looking towards the future, actually, there isn't really any purpose there after all. All of these things happen. And then you think, then what? Okay, I have a family, I have got a job and career, and so what? Big deal. So all of those things that seem so purposeful when you are young, moving forward, after a while you wonder about this. And this, I think, is one of the reasons as you get older, people often become more spiritually interested, because they realize that life has been life has been a bit of a con, right? It doesn't actually get you anywhere, unfortunately. It doesn't really, all those promises were just empty. There isn't actually anywhere you're going. There isn't any real aim after all. And this is true also in the bigger picture of samsara. We're just roaming and wandering on, aimlessly, purposely, having no goal, having no destinations. The simile of the stick, you throw a stick up in the air, now you get reborn here, now you get reborn there, in a kind of aimless sequence of births, happy, sad, in between. Oh, enough, right? Enough of all this. Let's get off this wheel of just running around without any point whatsoever. So, anyways, that is the no beginning can be found to this roaming around. That's when you start to get a bit worried about that. And then you have the nice simile here of why this is happening. Suppose, because a dog tied upon a leash was bound to a strong post or pillar. If it walks, it walks close to that post or pillar. If it stands close to that post or pillar. If it sits down close to that post or pillar. If it lies down close to that post or pillar. So too, because the uninstructed worldling, the putujana, regards form thus: this is mine, this I am, this is myself. He regards feeling, perception, willed activities and consciousness thus: this is mine, this I am, this is myself. If he walks close to those five aspects of personality or aspects of existence, subject to clinging. If he stands close to those five aspects of existence, subject to clinging. If he sits down close to those five aspects of existence, subject to clinging. If he lies down close to those five aspects of existence that are subject to clinging. So the idea here, you know, this dog that is tied up on the leash, right, to a strong pillar. The pillar here is this I am, is the five khandhas, right? This is the pillar, and we are bound to those five khandhas because we cling to them, because we are attached to them, because we identify them with them. This is me, right? And of course, if this really is you, you have to be attached. You have no say in the matter, really. And whatever you do, wherever you go, wherever you get reborn, right, if you sit, you stand, you lie down, this I just take to be a metaphor for whatever happens, whatever rebirth you have, this is all there ever is, just these five khandhas. In every type of rebirth, wherever you go, this is always what you take to be yourself. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And because of that, you are tied to these khandhas, tied to these aspects of personality or aspects of existence, if you like. There never is anything apart from that. You're like this dog, right, tied on a leash. And of course, if you're tied on a leash, you are not free. You are bound. You are imprisoned by these things. And then the Buddha says, therefore, bhikkhus, one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by lust, hatred, and delusion. Through the defilement of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. So this presumably is because he is realizing the reason why I'm tied to all of these things is because of defilements, right? Defilements are what tie me down and they make the matter far worse. And then he understands that the solution is to cleanse the mind. And by cleansing them, beings are purified. And then you are heading in the right direction. So then we have these nice little similes that come up next. These are similes, again, that talk about the creative activity of the mind, how the mind ultimately is what creates everything, creates all existence, all rebirth, etc., etc. Bhikkhus, have you seen the picture called Faring On? Yes, Venerable Sir. Even that picture called Faring On has been designed in its diversity by the mind, yet the mind is even more diverse than the picture called Faring On. So this presumably is just some art, perhaps art that was, you know, that they would did in those days. Probably some very quite spectacular art, maybe a picture which is very complicated and diverse. But whatever art you create in the world, you know, whatever you do, all of that, of course, comes from the mind. The mind creates art in exactly the way that mind creates a rebirth. And it's quite scary. I know, you know, if you look at some of the modern art that is available these days, some of that art is just terrible. You look at it, you think, wow, what kind of mind has created that sort of art? If you know what I mean, you must be pretty dark mind to create some of these pieces of art that are available. You look at it and you feel you just want to turn away and look in a different direction. It is so horrible. And you can see then how it is that people create also the bad destinations, right? You create the bad destination in the same way that you create a piece of artwork that is really unpleasant, almost revolting in a sense. Therefore, Bhikkhus, one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by lust, hatred, and delusion. Through the defilements of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. So you want to create a beautiful picture rather than create a bad one. That is the first step. And ultimately, you want to erase the picture altogether and have no picture whatsoever. And then you are going in the right direction. Because I do not see any other order of living beings so diversified as those in the animal realm. But even those beings in the animal realm have been diversified by the mind. Yet the mind is even more diverse than those beings in the animal realm. Every animal, every being in this universe has been created by the mind. I mentioned the dog duty ascetic this morning, right? You're actually creating the dog mind by thinking like that. And every animal shape has been created through our mental attitudes, our way of developing the mind. It's a bit worrying, right? We've all been there. We have all created those minds at a certain stage. And we probably will all create them again in the future. Right? So this is what happens. If you stay on in samsara, you will eventually create these things. This is just the nature of things. You go up and down. You get into the wrong company. You lose your kalyanamittas and you get your papamittas instead. Papamitta is the bad friend which drags you in the wrong direction. And that is when you start creating these rather unpleasant potentials for rebirth in the future. Right? You think about the animal realm. It's actually very diverse. You know, it isn't. You have the land animals, you have the birds, you have the snakes and reptiles, you have the fish in the sea. And all of that is kind of innocent. You even have the kangaroos in Australia, one of the animals in the animal realm. Sometimes you think, oh, some of these animals are very cute, right? Kangaroos are very nice and furry, cute. Sometimes they get so friendly in the monastery that you can pat them on the back. That's how friendly some of these kangaroos get sometimes. So they seem very cute. They've got kind of big brown eyes, right? Very, very nice. And then you see them in nature and you start to see what kangaroo life really is like. And it's actually quite desperate and quite bad. They get very angry with each other. They fight each other with food. And everything is about survival, about fighting, and about sleeping and eating grass. That's really what their life is all about, and fighting each other. It's full of greed, full of delusion, full of hatred and anger. That is the reality of the animal life. And of course, that is the kangaroo. Kangaroo life is pretty good. But the vast majority of animal life is like insects, right? Like these insects flying around me right now. Like all these mosquitoes and worms and what have you. That is often the reality of animal life. Very diverse and a lot of suffering and problems in the animal world. Therefore, bhikkhus, one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by greed, hatred and delusion, or desire, anger and delusion. Through the defilement of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. And then we have the same simile we saw before. Suppose, bhikkhus, an artist or a painter using dye or lac or turmeric or indigo or crimson would create the figure of a man or a woman complete in all his features on a well-polished plank or wall or canvas. So too, when the uninstructed worldling produces anything, it is only form that he produces, only feeling that he produces, only perception that he produces, only willed activities that he produces, only consciousness that he produces. So we produce our future existence, right? Just like a painter paints this picture in the same way, we produce our existence in the future. But whatever it is that you produce, it is always the five khandhas. It is not possible to produce anything apart from that. This is all you ever produce. And because the five khandhas are impermanent, because they are subject to fading away, because they are subject to change at all times, you're never producing anything which lasts. You're always producing these things which will eventually disappear and fade away. In the meantime, you attach to them. And because you attach to them and then fade away, then you suffer as a consequence. So you are creating all of these things that can only lead to suffering in the future. Okay. So that's why it says here, next one, it's all impermanent, etc. And just forget about that one. This is the standard ending of these suttas. We'll just leave that aside for now. So that is basically a little bit about upadana and bhava, right? Existence. You can see here the existence of the various realms, how they are created, how all of these things are created by the mind. And of course, that creating activity happens with the upadana. We take things up and we live accordingly. And when we live accordingly, we create the karma, which then leads to the rebirth, etc., into those realms. Now I want to look at in more detail about between the connection between existence and birth. This is the next thing coming up here. So let us have a quick look at the next couple of suttas, first of all, and then we will talk about this in more detail. Existence is the condition for birth. Birth is the condition for old age and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Such is the origination of this whole mass of suffering. With the cessation of existence, there is a cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And what, bhikkhus, is birth? The birth of various beings into the various orders of beings, their being born, descent into the womb, production, the manifestation of the aggregates, the obtaining of the senses. This is called birth. And what, bhikkhus, is old age and death? The old age of various beings in the various orders of beings. They're growing old. The brokenness of teeth, the grayness of hair, the wrinkling of the skin, the decline of vitality, the degeneration of the faculties. This is called old age. the passing away of various beings from various orders of beings, their perishing, breakup, disappearance, mortality, death, completion of time, the breakup of the aggregates, the laying down of the carcass. This is called death. Thus, this old age and this death are together called old age and death. So, the first thing to note here, of course, is that the way that birth, old age, and death are defined here, it's very clear that what is meant is the ordinary old age of death and the birth of beings. It is not some kind of metaphor or some kind of simile for something else. It is the literal meaning of this word, which is obviously meant by these definitions here. And the conditionality that we're seeing, the conditionality between existence and birth, is exactly the same conditionality that we were looking at before between sankhara and vijnana. It's exactly the same thing that we're looking at. Right, so I've just been talking about this now, and maybe just repeat very briefly again. We live in a certain existence depending on all our attachments. Our mind tends to be preoccupied by certain things, interested in certain things, aiming for certain things, right? Our purpose is always to enjoy more of whatever it is we're enjoying, enjoying sense pleasures, enjoying states of meditation, whatever it is, mind is pointing towards that, aiming towards those things. And when our mind, and then we do karma according to that, sometimes bad karma, sometimes good karma. And this karma, the accumulation of karma, gives a color to our mind. It can be a positive color, a positive quality, which makes the mind light and bright, or it can be a darkening quality, or a dark or bad color, which makes the mind kind of negative and dark and painful. So then again, the mind is like equivalent to a particular type of existence. So because the mind has reached a type of existence in this life, a type of level in this life, when you die, you have all that karma, all that particular level you're at, is then where you continue into the future. And that is your jati, right? The direct link between bhava and jati. The two things together, the pointing of the mind in a certain place, because that is where your interest is, that's what you're aiming at, and also the quality of consciousness at the same time. So we're seeing exactly the same thing as we saw at the beginning. And you can see here that the avidya plus sankhara plus vijnana is very much the same as tanha plus upadana plus bhava plus jati. The same thing is just explained in slightly different ways. And so you can compare them, and then you can get a better understanding of these terms as you compare them in this way. So that is how this jati comes about, right? Then, of course, once you have the jati, then all this other stuff must happen. You have to become old, right? Old age. Pali word here for old age is jara. Jara. And jara is sometimes translated into English as aging, right? But aging doesn't really quite fit the bill, right? If you look at the definition here of jara, it is obviously means old age, the grayness of the hair and all of these kind of things. It actually means old age. That is the appropriate translation of the term, and not aging here. Then all of these problems arise as a consequence. And because then you are just continuing into this samsaric cycle, going around and around, and no escape from it can be found. Now I would like to have a look at a sutta called the Divine Messengers, and this is called known as the Deva Dutta Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's a nice little sutta that kind of talks about the idea of a rebirth. It is a slightly mythological sutta because it talks about the King Yama, etc., and this King Yama seems to be something that was inherited at that time from the Brahmanical religion, seemed to be an idea that also existed there. The Lord of Death, King Yama. But although it has a slightly mythological element to it, it also has some nice things about the process of rebirth itself. And this is also one of those places where it makes sense to think of this in terms of the antarabhava, the intermediate existence. That is how this probably makes the best sense to understand this particular passage. So this Divine Messengers. When monks, King Yama has questioned, examined, and addressed him thus concerning the second divine messengers. He again questions, examines, and addresses the man about the third one, saying, "Didn't you ever see, my good man, the third divine messenger appearing among humankind?" "No, Lord, I did not see him." "But, my good man, didn't you ever see a woman or a man 1, 2, or 3 days dead, the corpse swollen, discolored, and festering?" "Yes, Lord, I have seen this." "Then, my good man, didn't it ever occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, 'I too am subject to death. I cannot escape me. Let me now do noble deeds, my body, speech, and mind.' No, Lord, I could not do it. I was negligent." "Through negligence, my good man, you have failed to do noble deeds by body, speech, and mind. Well, you will be treated as befits your negligence. That evil action of yours was not done by your mother and father, brother, sister, friends, or companions, nor by the relatives, devas, ascetics, or brahmins, but by you alone have done that bad deed, and you will have to experience the fruit." So this is what is going on here, is the person, after he has passed away, right, after he has died, and he goes into this existence. And you can see he hasn't really been properly been reborn yet, because it's talking about here that you will have to experience the fruit. In other words, we are kind of in the process of, you know, you're in the process of moving towards that realm where you will experience that fruit. So, and this is quite nice. It's sort of says something, I think, about the process of rebirth, what actually happens in that one. And you can see here, first of all, King Yama, he examines him, right? He questions him about his deeds in the past. And I think very often this is precisely what happens at the end of our life. We start to summarize our life, we look at how we lived, and we start to put it all together. Did I live well? Did I live badly? Right, you may have, when you read about this near-death experience that people often have, very often part of that near-death experience is like a life review, where you see your whole life in panorama, and you can accumulate all the actions that you did, right? You see everything. And sometimes they say you also see how those actions actually affected the people around you. You see the suffering that you created. You see the happiness you created in the people around you. And of course, that will have a very powerful impact on you, right? You will feel the sense, you will feel bad about yourself if you did things that had a negative impact on other people. So what this examining and questioning of King Yama, I think, is really about is our own examination of ourselves, our own looking at our own life and then judging ourselves. And then when we judge ourselves, right, once you have judged, then you have a feeling for what kind of rebirth you deserve. You know what you deserve. You know what is right for you. It's nobody doing it for you. It's nobody actually judging you at all. You know where you deserve to go. And this is why we send ourselves to the new destination. Karma is part of this feeling of what you are worth in this life, what is worthy for you. So, of course, the problem with this man, one of the things that this man has neglected, is that he has neglected thinking about death, right? He hasn't done any death contemplation. Yes, he sort of knew that he was going to die, but he didn't really take it seriously. So this again shows us that part of this shows us the power of death contemplation. Just seeing the dead person, just reminding ourselves we're going to die, that takes away some of the intoxication, some of the blindness, and it reminds us of the urgency to do what is right in the world. Do good acts by body, speech, and mind. It reminds us of the importance of that. I will have a little bit more look at death contemplation later on, but already here we can see it coming up. And then he asks him, "Well, you know, surely, you know, you are intelligent and you are mature. Didn't it occur to you that you should be doing good?" And then he says, "No, I was negligent. I was apamada." Unfortunately, pamada is no excuse. Even though you are pamada, even you are negligent, it doesn't really help. You can't. There's no excuse there, right? You have done those bad acts. And then, for that reason, he says, "You will be treated as befits your negligence." right? You alone have done these things, and you alone will have to experience the fruit. It is not really Yama, the king of death or whatever, who sends him onto the new realm. Yama is not functioning as a judge here. You can see what is really happening is that he is judging himself. He is going to experience the fruits because of that. Yama is not actually doing anything in particular. Yama is just a metaphor here for the judging process that happens within each person themselves. So, because of that, you then send yourself, right, into a new existence as befits those deeds that you have done, those bad actions that you did. Nobody else did them. You yourself did them. And because of that, you feel responsibility. So that is this nice little interlude, and it shows you again the idea of the Antarabhava. And of course, again, just to reiterate on this point I was making before, and that is the reason why you feel responsible is because of the sense of self, right? Remember, you identify with the doer. I am the doer. If you have done actions in the past that were bad, you identify with those. You feel responsible. You have to own those actions because you literally think you are that thing which did those actions. The activity, the volition, the sankharas, sankharas being the activities you do, this is who you think you are. So you have no choice but to judge yourself. If you did them, well, that's, you know, that's what happens. And this is kind of the thing which is becoming a stream enter, why that is so powerful to become a stream enter. Because once you understand that these things have nothing to do with you, then forgiving yourself becomes suddenly so easy. Well, actually, I didn't do this. It was just the conditioning of the sankharas, all these things coming together. That is what made me do these activities. So that is why the stream mentor can forgive themselves much more easily than a putujana. Putujana, we can do a little bit of forgiveness, but we can only take it so far. There's always going to be a residue of sense of responsibility for those actions. And because there is a residue of responsibility, there will always be a residue of judgment of yourself. And you yourself sends yourself into that new existence, whatever you think that it is that you deserve. Okay, so that is the little sutta on divine messenger. Sometimes I've also read about near-death experience where people actually have gone into this intermediate existence, or at least that's the experience they have, and they have actually experienced that there's been somebody there judging them, right? They have this feeling of sitting in front of like a panel, some lead judge, probably being equivalent to King Yama, and some kind of secretaries on the side, kind of taking notes or whatever, right? All the bad things you have done. That's kind of the experience people sometimes have. And apparently this experience was in some Western country, so it wasn't anybody who had read this particular sutta or was influenced by this worldview. So even the idea of King Yama may actually be more real, perhaps, than we think. It looks like here it is a metaphor, but sometimes that actually may be part of even the real experience that people have. It's quite interesting sometimes to compare the suttas with some of the experience that people have in this world. So that is the idea of bhava, and another little sutta there on the idea of the antarabhava as well. I think we better stop there because we're getting very close to the hour. And we will continue tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning I intend to finish up with dependent origination and then move on to other suttas which are more directly to do with developing the mind after that. So that is all for now, and I'll see you again at 7 o'clock this evening here.